Welcome back to the Damage Report. I am your temporary host, Francesca Fiorentini. What's going on? Hope everyone is good. John Iadarola will be back. Don't get upset. But for now, we got a big job to do. It is a big news. It's not a big news Wednesday. It's a large news Thursday. That's what it is. We got a lot to get to. Super glad you guys are here. And with me, longtime journalist, but now full-time TYT newest host, Mr. David Schuster. Welcome.
Francesca, it is an honor to be with you. And with all the dragons that are out there on this day, we're gonna have some fun.
Absolutely. Have you been assigned a dragon name?
Well, you know, I came up with one the last time that didn't seem to work, I think, but the viewers are now saying Rebel Dragon because some of the videos that I do on Rebel HQ. So that sort of seems to fit. I think my friends and family would laugh at anybody calling me a rebel, but whatever. We'll go with it.
The world has changed a lot since you got into the game of journalism, and suddenly just telling the truth makes you a rebel. So yeah. I feel like it checks out.
Okay, I'm with you, but it's an honor to be on with you today.
It's really good to have you. We got a lot to get to, so make sure y'all, are you liking the like button? Yeah, are you sharing the stream? Are you staying tuned for Dr. Rashad Ritchie, who's coming up after this show with his own show, Indisputable, which is no longer streaming right after this show. You gotta go over to youtube.com/IndisputableTYT to watch it there, 2:30 Eastern, 11:30 AM Pacific. Make sure to watch it there. Let's just get into it. David, you ready for this?
I'm ready. I'm thrilled.
Okay. It's not so thrilling, our opener, but I promise it will get progressively more fun as the hours go by. So let's begin.
I am also a survivor of sexual abuse. And I believe without a doubt that the circumstances that led to my abuse and allowed it to continue are directly the result of the fact that the organizations created by Congress to oversee and protect me as an athlete, USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee failed to do their jobs. Nelson Mandela once said, there can be no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way in which it treats its children. It is the power of that statement that compels and empowers me to be here in front of you today. I don't want another young gymnast, Olympic athlete, or any individual to experience the horror that I and hundreds of others have endured before, during, and continuing to this day in the wake of the Larry Nassar abuse. To be clear,
take your time.
To be clear, I blame Larry Nassar, and I also blame an entire system that enabled and perpetrated his abuse. USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee knew that I was abused by their official team doctor long before I was ever made aware of their knowledge.
So that is Olympic gold medalist, gymnast Simone Biles, the GOAT, of course, testifying before Congress, a Senate Judiciary Committee, along with fellow gymnasts about the FBI's inaction after being told of the many abuses by their physician, Larry Nassar. They have testified before, they have told this story before. That was to a judge. Larry Nassar has been sentenced to something like 265 years to life in prison. Whichever comes first, that's a lot of years. But there she is. This is not about Larry Nassar. This is about the inaction of the FBI and of the Olympic Committee and of USA Gymnastics. So Simone Biles says that the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee, quote, failed to do their jobs. And that is because A report found that even though gymnasts first reported the sexual assault allegations to the FBI in 2015, Larry Nassar continued to treat gymnasts at the Michigan State University, a high school and gymnastics club, until September 2016. The hearing Wednesday also included testimony from decorated gymnasts Michaela Maroney, Allie Raceman, Maggie Nichols, who described their abuse in graphic detail and called for the institutions and people who should have protected them to be held accountable. I just want to play one more clip. This is from Michaela Maroney.
Chose to lie about what I said and protect a serial child molester rather than protect not only me, but countless others. I was naked, completely alone, with him on top of me, molesting me for hours. I told them I thought I was going to die that night. I began crying at the memory over the phone, and there was just dead silence. After that minute of silence, he asked, "Is that all?" The truth is, my abuse was enough, and they wanted to cover it up. They chose to falsify my report and to not only minimize my abuse, but silence me yet again. They allowed a child molester to go free for more than a year. What is the point of reporting abuse if our own FBI agents are going to take it upon themselves to bury that report in a drawer?
So there you have it. That is Michaela Maroney testifying that when she went to the FBI, that they not only treated her callously, but also sat on that report for many years. I want to turn over to David Schuster, just thoughts and reactions to this.
Well, look, it was heart-wrenching to see any of this testimony yesterday. And I think it was very important for everybody to see, because there is a culture at the FBI, at least there has been a culture at the FBI, that tends to be, you know, very sort of macho culture that is perhaps dismissive of female athletes, particularly female children. And while Christopher Wray, who's the FBI director, was not in charge of the FBI back in 2015 or 2016, it wasn't that long ago that this was going on. The other thing that just is so striking about it, in addition to, I think, the need to change the culture of the FBI, which I think Christopher Wray is starting to do, and the FBI agent was fired who was involved in sort of taking these reports, but it is so inspiring. It is so courageous for these women, not only to sort of make the initial report 5 or 6 years ago, but also to have the courage to go in front of Congress, where senators are not usually the most sort of sensitive or maybe plugged into gymnastics that you would imagine, or to athletes, for them to be able to go and take that sort of public stand and say, this matters, and I was hurt by this. I mean, I just think that shows an even greater strength than any of their physical feats that they're able to do in their somersaults or anything else in their routines. I mean, the strength it takes to be able to do this is really inspiring and underscores why these are such amazing role models for all of our children and daughters and sons and everybody else.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, I can't help but think about the recent Olympics, right? And what happened when Simone Biles was last in the news, which was her decision to not compete, feeling like she was not in the mental state to compete, feeling like she might injure herself gravely if she did compete. And she got, you know, thrown through the ringer by the media, by a lot of right wingers, of course, who, of course, it should not be lost on anyone that they went after her specifically because she is a woman, because she is a black woman, she's a female athlete, you know, and then you see the kinds of things that have been going on behind the scenes. So look, it's one thing to not stand up for your players or to feel like they're hung out to dry in front of the media, right? In front of the sort of seething, teeming media, always trying to get a bite of these athletes. And then it's another to see actually behind the scenes that for years, it's not just the FBI, but it is also USA Gymnastics. It is also the Olympic Committee, that there were rumors, there were reports. We're talking about, I misspoke, it was 265 women and girls that Larry Nassar abused, right? 175 years in prison. So, I mean, it is very understandable that at this point, these incredible gymnasts should feel completely mistrustful of any of the institutions that they work for, that they're making money for, right? That all the advertisements that they are propping up, and yet when it comes to them having their backs, they haven't.
Yeah, and you mentioned institutions. I mean, the other thing that just still strikes me, and you know, full clarification. I mean, I went to the University of Michigan, which is only about 70 miles away from East Lansing, where Michigan State University, the Big Ten schools, all of them. You're talking about the premier athletic departments, the premier institutions of higher learning. So for this to slip under the radar or to be ignored at Michigan State University, a Big Ten member university, is unfathomable. And so clearly, I mean, Michigan State has been trying to sort of change their culture and figure out what went wrong, and there have been huge payouts. But again, not that long ago, at some of the most respected institutions in our country, and for athletes just 5 or 6 years ago, to not be able to trust in some of the premier institutions of higher education, some of the premier institutions in terms of amateur athletics, again, says so much about where we are as a society and how much more work we still have to do, particularly when it comes to women in athletics.
Yes. Oh yeah, and also not to mention the bad faith discussions around preventing trans people from, you know, playing on the teams that they want to, you know, and oh, we gotta protect women and girls sports. We gotta protect, excuse me. You sat on this report for months. I want to go to a quote, Ali Raisman, who also an Olympic medalist, also part of the USA Gymnastics team, or former. Ali Raisman, who is a retired gymnastics from gymnastics and competed with Maroney at the 2012 Olympics in London, said it took the FBI 14 months to interview her about the allegations against Nassar. Raisman said that the FBI, USAG, and USOPC quietly allowed Nassar to slip out the side door and continue his work, finding more than 100 new victims to molest. I mean, that's chilling, right? To know that as a survivor, as someone who's been victimized, that you could have, you know, these women wanted to prevent there to be future victims, right? And that is, you know, that's the other thing that happens when women speak out, right? What's in it for them is the discussion. What are they angling for? What do they want? Oh, they just want headlines, et cetera. And look, I understand this is an extreme case of abuse, but we know that the victims often get re-victimized by the, you know, the narratives and the lies told about them and about their so-called claim, you know, searching for fame. Well, what they're searching for is to prevent this from happening. What they're searching for is justice, but really more than justice, it's to put these people out of harm's way or out of the way of other young girls and women who could potentially be victimized.
You know, and it hits home personally to me, Francesca, because I have an 8-year-old daughter who loves gymnastics. And because of all this stuff, I mean, my wife and I now, you know, we're sort of on guard when our daughter goes to her gymnastics club, because if it can happen at a Michigan State University at the highest levels of gymnastics, surely it can happen at other places as well. And to have that conversation with your 8-year-old daughter who loves gymnastics about, okay, here's some things that you need to be on guard for, because this is part of our society. It is heart-wrenching, it is disturbing. These are our children. And anybody says, oh no, we're talking about 14 and 15 year olds. No, you're talking about kids who are as young as 11, 12 years old, who are sort of at the peak of their gymnastics career, the formative years. And to think that they're not safe when they're doing their gymnastics, something that they love, and that they have to be on guard against predators. I mean, it's just sickening.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, the last thing I'll say on this is that, you know, I think that sometimes the silence, especially in these industries that are supposedly elite, like you're saying, like Michigan State University and, you know, Olympic committees, right? Like a lot of that silence comes because you put too much trust in these institutions that supposedly are supposed to support the athletes. And you're like, well, how could this be abuse if this is a, you know, a physician that has been contracted and hired by USA Gymnastics, who's been working for them for decades, right? And there have been accomplices. Look, once again, nobody does this stuff alone, all right? And there were accomplices in this case, one man who actually took his own life instead of face justice on this. But I think that's often what prevents survivors from speaking out. You know, Simone Biles, she's an Olympic gold medalist. You know what it is to come forward to the world and say, I am pretty much the best in the game, right? And yes, I too was victimized. Because it's half of it you don't believe that your institution would hang you out to dry, and half of it is an exercise in humility and an exercise in bravery for saying, yeah, no, I too can actually be victimized. I too can be like I don't know. I would say like duped in this case, right? And told and fed lies about this person.
And it's almost, Francesca, it's almost like duped because there's an incentive that still exists to produce wins, to produce gold medals. And one of the best coaches that I've ever known said, look, you know, I say, what kind of team are we going to have? And he says, you ask me in 20 years from now, when you know, your teammates in terms of what kind of husbands and fathers and human beings they are, and then I'll be able to tell you what kind of team you had. That's how it should be throughout amateur athletics. It's not about churning out gold medals and churning out wins. It's about developing everybody's character. That has to matter.
Yeah. And like David said, the FBI agent who did handle this case was fired. But I think you could argue that is such a big case that it really, how could it have been just one person? So it's that culture of the FBI that I think, well, a lot of us fundamentally disagree with. But there can be reforms even with such a within such a apparently broken institution. We got to take our first break, but stay right there. We're coming back. Welcome back to the Damage Report, Francesca Fiorentini, David Schuster. Let's get into this next story. So it's been a good week for Californians, at least the Californians who believe in science and minimum wage and things like that. Not only did California defeat the Republican recall this week and avoid the fate of a Larry Elder governor, but now California is the only state in the country that isn't in the highest bracket of transmission level when it comes to COVID-19. So take a look at this map. Just a pretty much a sea of red, except for, I believe, Puerto Rico. And I think, is that Hawaii there? Who are not in the highest level of transmission. So the state's transmission level has fallen from high to substantial, the second highest tier as defined by the CDC. I had no idea about these tiers because I need things in like the war on terror color codes. And we haven't had those. So I didn't even know these tiers existed, but California has gotten into the lower tier. We've achieved it. As of Tuesday night, California is the only state that has fallen into this category, as is Puerto Rico. The CDC scale evaluating coronavirus transmission levels categorizes states as being one of four tiers: worst, red, substantial, orange, moderate, yellow, low, blue. So California entered the second highest tier of coronavirus transmission Monday night, a tier it shared with two other states, Connecticut and Vermont, as well as the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. But by Tuesday night, Connecticut, Vermont, and the District of Columbia had fallen back into the worst tier. So, okay, what does this mean numbers wise? Let's talk about it. Nationwide, the US is seeing an average of 295 cases per 100,000 people and a positivity rate of 9.5%. California is seeing 20 new cases per 100,000 people and a positivity rate of 4.4%. So, pretty good. Pretty good numbers. I wish I had compared them or could compare them to some places in the world. But honestly, it feels good because I feel like you look at the global hotspots and then you look at where the concentration of vaccines are, and it's the same place. And that is the United States of a exceptional America. And so it feels good that at least one state is taking the responsibility of having all the vaccines correctly and actually getting these numbers down.
I'm totally with you. I mean, I'm sort of, you know, curious to hear a little bit more about what is it that California is doing that's different from where I am here in Connecticut. And I think I know, just in terms of, it feels like there's it just feels like the percentage of people who are getting vaccinated is a little bit higher in California. But the other thing, that strikes me with all this, I mean, the big news, of course, in California was the recall, as you mentioned right off the top, Gavin Newsom holding on. It is such great responsibility, in my view, to hold off on this news, whoever, you know, had the news and the data, to wait until the recall election is over. And then you put it out there. And even though this is news that clearly would have favored Gavin Newsom, and in my view, you know, it was great that Gavin Newsom was not recalled, it shows that there is a certain level of responsibility that still exists in politics when people are able to say, okay, let's just let the voters focus on the recall. And then after the election's over, then we can give them, oh, here's the update in terms of all this news, in terms of how California is doing. So I thought that was an incredibly responsible and great, and adds credibility to the system. But again, you know, congratulations to California. It has been a great week. And I just hope, you know, usually what starts in California ends up across the United States anyway. Hopefully this is the beginning of a wave, a good wave in terms of the numbers coming down, that as the trend goes down in California, hopefully other states, at least those that take vaccination seriously, will also follow suit.
I mean, 100%. As much as I want to gloat being in California, I care about the rest of the nation. I truly do. And I agree with that. I mean, Connecticut, you got there for a little bit and then now you're back to a higher transmissibility. But as David said, there's reasons for California doing better. One is they're more cautious than the CDC. So in July, the CDC said the vaccinated teachers and students don't need to wear masks inside school buildings. But California said its mask guidance for schools would remain in place. California residents are also more likely to be vaccinated than residents in other states. Honestly, as someone who's the sister of a Oakland public school teacher, I am very happy that the regulations are in place and students and their teachers, no matter their vaccination status, are masked. But you mentioned, David, the recall, and there is a map, and I'm gonna put up the map. There are obviously hotspots in California, you know, 20 people per 100,000 is not great. But here is a map that shows the California recall results and the COVID heat map, or sort of where COVID is the worst. And I think we can all see the correlation. So in blue is where people voted to yes, recall Gavin Newsom, maybe have Larry Elder, who doesn't believe in a minimum wage, as new governor, who doesn't believe in any kind of lockdown. And then you have the COVID heat map over here, and it's the same regions. And so you gotta wonder, like, what do the folks who voted for this recall want? Do they want the entire state to be, you know, to have more transmissibility? Do they want more COVID? Like, I'm seriously, honestly, politically unclear, David. I don't know if you've figured this out yet. What is the Republican strategy here?
I think the Republican strategy is anti-science, anti-facts, and there's a selfishness that runs through it. I mean, if you look at these people who refuse to get vaccinated, they say, well, they're really not that concerned about infecting other members of the community. In other words, they are the consummate selfish people in your neighborhood, in your community. And so, but I thought that, you know, kudos to whoever pulled up that map and made that comparison, because that is visually so gripping and so compelling, and it couldn't be more clear. And I think if you looked at the United States, and there it is, the California heat map on the left, of course, is the where, you know, Gavin Newsom did well in the blue are the counties that where the recall was strong, and then the red and the orange are where the vaccination rates are low and it's hot. I mean, I think if we had a map of the United States, it would show the same thing. And that is, there is a direct correlation now between being a conservative and being at greater danger of dying from COVID-19. There's cause and there's effect. It couldn't be clearer. And yet there are people who still we'll see these maps and they'll say, oh, that's the media. You can't trust the media, or you can't trust the CDC, or you can't trust the National Institutes of Health or the FDA. At a certain point, our society has to figure out, well, what are we gonna do about these people who are the flat earthers in our society, who are endangering the rest of us? If they wanna go and stay at home all day long, never mix with the rest of the population, fine, don't be vaccinated, but don't send your kids to our schools, don't go to our grocery stores, don't mix with the rest of us. And they still do that. It is the height of irresponsibility, and they are causing all of us to be in danger because of this, and they're keeping the pandemic going. And if you don't like masks and you don't like vaccinations, the best thing you can do is try to end the damn pandemic. That's what you should be doing.
Yeah, stopping the spread is what you need to be doing. And actually, you're 100% right that national maps do mirror what happens in California, that the places that are being hardest hit are redder states, are counties that did vote for Trump disproportionately, right? And it's very difficult because shoe on the other foot, you know, if somehow Democrats sort of went down a bizarre rabbit hole and stopped believing in science and then started dying en masse, you know, Republicans would be rubbing our faces in it. You know, they would relish it and love it. And look, we're not. We're like, no, we want to get back to living our lives. We want actual freedom. We actually want to save the children by preventing them from dying, as we've seen, you know, COVID in children actually claiming more and more of their lives, which is terrifying. That map was put together by the Lincoln Project, who I have a lot of problems with. I think they have problems with themselves, but their social media game stays crushing it. And look, I live in California, and I just want to say something about the recall. The other thing that the recall did that is not okay is I'm convinced that if there wasn't a recall, if there wasn't $300 million wasted on this undemocratic process a year before an actual election, I don't think we'd see these bad numbers of the Delta variant and of the surges, even in these redder counties. In fact, I think we would have stopped the spread even more because Gavin Newsom wouldn't have felt so much political pressure to not say do another lockdown, which honestly I think California should have done and may still need to do. And like, this is not hats off to him. This is actually on him. It's not okay to not go forward with a safety regulation just because you're afraid of your own political behind, right? And yet politicians do that all the time. That's what they're doing across this country. And so I hope that now that Newsom has defeated the recall, that he will do the smart thing. And if the surge or if the Delta variant and if the numbers are not going in the direction they need to be going in this state, that he will again ask for another lockdown and to have more money directed to small businesses and restaurants, et cetera, who need it and need the assistance.
Francesca, that is such an astute point politically, because I'm old enough to remember having covered the 2005 California recall of Gray Davis when Arnold Schwarzenegger came in. And Gray Davis was paralyzed politically by that. I think, maybe Gavin Newsom is a little bit sort of different, but your point is right on. I mean, if he's looking at losing his job, he's not going to be taking major risks, political risks, even if it's the right thing to do health-wise. And the other point that you make, which is so brilliant, we look at these conservatives who supported the recall, who wanted Gavin Newsom out of office, and in case after case, community after community, they also claim to be somehow pro-life. And yet it seems like over and over, these churches, these right-wing evangelicals are only pro-birth. We want you to be born, and then after that, you're totally on your own. And it doesn't really matter if the family infects everybody else and makes everybody else in danger if you die because of COVID or anything else, or malnutrition or lack of education or anything else. We just want you to be born. And to me, that it's like the ultimate hypocrisy that exists across evangelicals and conservatives in the United States. And it should be, Jesus said what? The second commandment, love thy neighbor as thyself. That to me seems an obligation to get the vaccine. If you really care that you're a good Christian or Jewish or whatever it is, of course you should be getting the vaccine. That's how you take care of your community. And for these right-wing hypocrites to sort of throw up their hands and say, no, we're not gonna do it. We're not gonna do it. We only care about ourselves. To me, that's like the least Judeo-Christian thing they could possibly do.
Yes, it's like the late George Carlin said, if you're pre-born, you're fine. If you're preschool, you're effed.
Right.
And it's always true, stays true. Let's move on to a different aspect of the fallout of the California recall defeat. Ben Shapiro, a man with the most fleek eyebrows, and a personified wedgie, is big mad about Californians defeating the recall of Governor Newsom. He is so mad and he's taken it pretty far. The first thing he's doing is, like himself, a former Californian, he's encouraging Republicans in that state to leave it. Take a look.
If you are a Republican in California, things are gonna get worse, not better. I've been saying this since I left, right? Follow me, get out while the getting is good. Move to a purple state, turn that state red. California is a lost cause. I know there are a bunch of people who are hanging on over there. I was one of them until a year ago. I'm much happier now that I have left the state. The state is, again, in an inexorable state of decline. The voters there are not interested in turning away from the path that they are now trotting. They're not turning away from higher taxes. They're not turning away from more regulation. They're not turning away from terrible records on crime and horrible records on education. They're not turning away from any of that stuff. They're embracing it. They're embracing the suck. So get out while the getting is good. There's plenty of opportunity in other states.
Yeah, go. Bye.
Yeah, don't let the door hit you on the way out.
Yeah, exactly. Follow Ben Shapiro. Get out while the going is good. I don't know. I just love this because as someone who lives here and like he's so terrified we're moving in the wrong direction on everything. Oh, No, I mean, look, there are things that Gavin Newsom is not doing well, but there are also things like providing healthcare to undocumented people that I firmly believe in, that I think is gonna keep all of us healthier and safer, and that we rely on the work of documented and undocumented immigrants all the time in this state and in the country. So honestly, this whole exodus out of California, David, I mean, as for personally, I'm like, I'd love to see it. Goodbye, go. And that's not to say that we, you know, look, it takes money to move out of the state. So if Ben Shapiro is gonna help the, you know, Republicans get the money to move, that's great. You know, and I'm not saying that, you know, people should only move. We, you know, we do have to make sure that this state works for everybody and that we, you know, close the income inequality gaps, right? That we make big tech pay their fair share, that we stop climate change, right? That we end the unhoused epidemic here, that we have rent control, that we get the real estate lobbyists under control, fossil fuel lobbies. We got a lot of work to do, but we don't need the Larry Elders and his followers. We don't need the Ben Shapiro nerds and their followers and their trickle down economics like guffing it all up. So go, fine. I'm totally fine with that.
It also strikes me, I mean, what whiners, what losers. I mean, the context of this is there's Ben Shapiro because Larry Elder did not win, because Gavin Newsom was not recalled. Oh, that's the moment when, oh, we lost an election. So everybody get out of California. Well, you know what? Ben Shapiro could have told California Republicans to get out 3 months ago, 6 months ago, but he chooses the day after the election recall. And oh, by the way, an election recall where the leading Republican was suggesting even before the votes were tabulated that there was fraud. So they claim fraud on the front end when it looks like they're gonna lose, then they lose. And instead of being a gracious loser and shaking the hand and saying, okay, you won, we'll see you in the next round, it's, well, I'm gonna take my ball and I'm gonna go home, or I'm gonna take it to Arizona or Texas. I mean, that is the consummate whiner. That's, you teach your children to be gracious losers. And these are not gracious losers, they are whiners.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just gonna say, look, love it or leave it, buddy. Just love it or leave it. But which is a little bit what Ben Shapiro continues to say, because that is not, that's not what the headline of his little rant over there. He continued and has an even more extreme suggestion for this country based on this failed recall that clearly was going to fail in this blue state. Take a look.
So on a national level, why should we care about California? Because what it actually presages is not just politics in California. What it presages is a question, whether we actually do want to remain part of the same body politic. If we do want to remain part of the same body politic, we're going to have to construct a system of a federal governance in which Texas can be Texas and California can be California. However, California has to let Texas be Texas. I think this is why you're hearing so much talk these days about a quote unquote civil war, or talk about secession, or talk about the country breaking apart. It's a serious question. Whenever you form a body politic, which is what happened at the founding and what happened again in the aftermath of the Civil War, if you form a body politic, you have to decide whether you wish to remain part of the same country. And if so, what common rules can you hold at the top level that everybody can agree to? Well, if the basic notion of American government is that the federal government's gonna make all the rules and it's just going to be a struggle for the power of the one ring, then this country is not going to last this way. It is just not. And maybe then the best hope for a lot of conservatives and maybe for a lot of liberals, depending on who's in control of that federal government, is a friendly separation.
Oh, a conscious uncoupling of the United States of America. There's Ben Shapiro essentially arguing for secession because the California recall did not go his way and the Republicans' way. David, thoughts on that?
I mean, Ben Shapiro ought to be careful what he wishes for, because the last time I checked, if you look at Republican states versus Democratic states, Republican states get a lot more money back from the federal government than they send in terms of tax revenue. Democratic states, state after state, contributes far more money to the federal government than they get back in return. So fine, you want to separate out these Republican states, these southern states, have at it and look at your economy and try to deal with your economy without the help of taxpayers in all of these blue states. So fine, you want to separate? I mean, never mind that it's against the law, that, you know, we fought a civil war, that it's, you know, considered treason. But you know, don't put it past the Ben Shapiro's, who, by the way, I mean, it's so interesting. Some Republicans say, oh yeah, he's an intellectual. He's not an intellectual. You ask any academics an intellectual, and they will tell you Ben Shapiro is a fraud. He does not know anything of what he's talking about, but because he talks fast, some conservatives apparently can't follow him. And they think, oh, he must be really smart, when he's really not.
That's very funny. It is amazing. There's like, well, it's moving real quick at me. Therefore, it must be smart. It's like how people think that, like, British, you know, people in the UK and in the English, you know, the whole thing, that they sound smart because their accents. I actually think that clearly. But I just love the idea that he's like peaceful. Oh, it can be peaceful. We'll just have a peaceful little separation. We'll have all the crazy gun nuts over here, armed to the teeth, and then all of the like the like immigrants, the people of color, the people who the like LGBTQ community over here, all the weed, obviously. I mean, it sounds like I don't know if we're ever gonna actually like that. Feels like a worse neighbor to have. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's better that we have to work together than being like. Than having just an incredibly armed, psychotic, like jingoistic neighbor to your to the next to you. That's me. That being said,
it's so overly simplistic, right? I mean, and that's the way these conservative pundits work. They oversimplify things, and then when you get into the fine print, when you tell some conservative audience, okay, here's what secession would actually look like, here's what it would mean for your state to succeed and secede, and here's all the problems and challenges, and they're like, oh no, I don't want to do that. It's sort of like when you tell people who are against vaccines, well, you know, your children are already required to get vaccines against, you know, mumps and rubella and measles and all the other things. Like, oh, really? And it's like a newsflash to them. But there's this like simplistic thinking that goes on that makes it impossible for these people to be rational. And of course, they're misled by, you know, cynical pundits like Ben Shapiro, who realize his audience is stupid. They're never going to be very sophisticated about the understanding of what secession would actually mean. So it's okay for him to make it so simplistic as, oh, we can just peacefully get along. We can all get along and be good for liberals too. Well, yeah. You know, that's not how things work.
No, I mean, as much as I honestly hope that California breaks into the Pacific Ocean and we can just go over and chill with Hawaii and then we can be just a greater Hawaii, like that is my ultimate goal. I do know that it is one unconstitutional, it's not allowed. Obviously, we fought a damn civil war over it and we might, you know, it seems like the issues that are coming to a head still have to do with the legacies of, you know, slavery and Jim Crow and an unfinished reconstruction in this country. And we gotta work that out together, y'all. Sorry, I wish we could take the easy way out, but we can't, right? You know, there is a part of me, if this were a relationship, I'd be like, you go your own way, bro. You got your own problems and you need to just like not blame anyone except yourself. You know, I'd like to see you try. But then the reality is no, we're in this together and we have to be. You know, provided that we eliminate the Electoral College, which is my stipulation for staying. Just want to put that out there. We got to take our second break. Sit tight, though. There is more of whatever this is, this goodness coming very soon. Hey, I'm still here. David's still here. We're still doing news. Hope everyone is. Just chilling, just enjoying life. By the way, I host a different show. I have my own podcast. It's called The Bituation Room. You guys should check it out. It's really fun. I got comics on, I got experts on. So if you like me, listen to The Bituation Room. Follow me at Franny Fio on all the things. It streams 5-8 Eastern on Sunday. If you don't like me, forget everything I just said. But we got to get into some more stories. So House committees are currently wheeling and dealing behind the scenes to try and tinker with the Build Back Better Act, also known as the Reconciliation Bill, also known as the filibuster workaround for the stuff that wasn't included in that initial infrastructure bill, which was bipartisan. This is all essentially to avoid Republicans striking down a $3.5 trillion attempt at actually helping Americans. Everything from climate resilience to helping home care workers to healthcare reform, like we're going to be talking about right now. Except the key to this is getting Democrats on board. And sadly, in one of those committees, seems like Democrats are not on board with a key piece of this, which is reining in the price of pharmaceuticals. Three House Democrats on a key committee join Republicans in rejecting a section of President Joe Biden's $3.5 trillion budget that proposed having Medicare negotiate prices, which would save the government money. Under the proposal, Medicare would effectively cap the amount it paid for drugs at 120% of the average price in Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Japan, and the United Kingdom. 120%, so we'll still be paying more. It's just capped. This would reduce the price of more expensive drugs in America and reduce federal spending by an estimated $456 billion over a decade, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. However, Democratic reps Scott Peters of California, Kathleen Rice of New York, and Kurt Schrader of Oregon each oppose the strategy, saying it discourages the development of new drugs. Okay. These are three, obviously three Democrats who had actually before in 2019 supported this exact bill. What does that show? It shows that the lobbyists that are working behind the scenes are working behind the scenes and they are crushing it. So the vote that they took in their committee showed that Democratic opposition to a high profile portion of the package and reflected a major victory for drug manufacturers, led by the advocacy group Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Before I let you jump in, David, I just want to show you more about those three who voted no. Scott Peters in June got donations from Pfizer, Quest Diagnostics, Merck, Gilead Science, Bristol Myers, Squibb, and Abbott Labs. Head of Pfizer personally donated $5,800 to Peters in May. Then Kathleen Rice in June got donations from Teva Pharma, CVS Health, AHA, PCMAs, PAC, and Molina Health. She appears to have gotten more money from insurers and hospitals who generally support drug pricing bills than pharma companies. And then Kurt Schrader got donations from Sanofi, Vertex, Merck, and Prime and Koch, all reported in June last quarter. So corporate donations are working. David? Thoughts?
Well, I mean, the standard argument that you hear from whether it's the pharmaceutical industry or anybody else that, oh no, if you eat into our profits, then somehow we're not going to be able to do the research and development to produce these wonderful drugs. That is absolute bunk. That is total nonsense. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies are already making a fortune. They're making a fortune from the vaccines. They're making a fortune from all sorts of other drugs. This was a reasonable solution that Democrats had in terms of pegging the cost that Medicare would pay for drugs and having a cap on it. The drug companies were still gonna make a lot of money from Medicare for these drugs under this proposal. But because some of them are so selfish and they're so wanting to grab as much money as possible, well, okay, they buy off their, you know, some of the centrist Democrats. And by the way, we should be very clear. I mean, progressives like to talk about, oh, you know, the Republicans, but no, centrist Democrats are also part of the problem. The centrist Democrats, the establishment Democrats who are bought and paid for by various industries, including big pharma, they still stand in the way of progress. And as a result, there are gonna be those, you know, grandmas and grandpas and, you know, aunts and uncles and various elderly people who cannot afford the drugs that Medicare is suggesting that they take because they have to, you know, they're too expensive. And as a result, they're gonna go without food or they're gonna cut back on all sorts of other things. That's what this is about. This is about making the drugs accessible to the most vulnerable people in our society, the people who are elderly and frail. And yet we're putting a priority on profits of the big pharma, and Democrats are doing this? It's just, it's sickening.
Right, and we're talking about Medicare, right? We're talking about the government's ability to negotiate prices. This, we're talking about an actual free market. And like the thing we all need to remember here is that when people say free market this, free market that, what we actually have is not a free market. We have monopolies, we have incredible amounts of subsidies, we have who then funnel back into lobbying to buy our democracy. It is not a free market currently, right? We understand that. Look, if it were a free market, then, you know, we wouldn't just be watching this show on like a few giant tech platforms, thanks to the tech overlords. However, thank you for your service, I think. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it is, none of this is a free market, right? So this was the Energy and Commerce Committee. That's where this detente happened. So these three Democrats voted against this, and it did not pass. However, the same language that is gonna be part of this larger bill did pass in the Ways and Means Committee, so it could make it, it seems like it will make it to that final bill. However, if that final bill is to be passed by the House, you need Democrats on board. And like David is saying, a lot of these centrist Democrats who are bought by big pharma are not gonna be on board. So Democrats can only afford to lose 3 votes on the Build Back Better Act when it reaches the House floor. They can't lose any in the Senate, of course, that's why it's filibuster proof. And this provision lost 3 votes in just one committee, right? So this is what folks are saying. There will be likely some drug price negotiation provision in the final package, but the less aggressive it is, the less it will reduce the cost of prescription drugs and the less cash Democrats will have freed up to cover the remainder of their agenda. And as long as the moderates are demanding that the whole package be paid for, that's a problem. That's according to Jim Newell from Slate. So again, that is basically saying a lot of the moderates are going into this negotiation, including Joe Manchin, including Kyrsten Sinema. And they're like, look, where does the money come from? How are we gonna pay for this $3.5 trillion? And you know, and the progressive Democrats are like, well, we raise the prices, we save all this money, excuse me, by not having to pay this much in for Medicare for these for this medicine. Right? So essentially we're saving whatever it was, $356 billion. There you go. There's some money right there. And then moderates are like, no, we can't do that to big pharma. We also can't do that. So no, where are we going? So anyway, they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. The machinations continue behind the scenes. Any last thoughts before we move on?
No, I look, you've got it pegged. And at a certain point, we as a society have to decide who are we gonna give the power to? Are we gonna give them to the pharmaceuticals? Which by the way, you know, Canada buys those same drugs for a lot cheaper than our government buys them. It is such a waste of money. And the pharmaceuticals are still making a ton of money regardless of whether they're selling to Canada or whether they're selling to the US government.
Moving on, so look, at least 7 conservative anti-mask, anti-vax conspiracy theorist radio hosts have died of COVID. And while we don't believe in relishing in those deaths, one of those hosts who recently died is really testing that commitment. Please meet Bob Einhardt. He is a Christian radio and TV host who was known for mocking people who died of AIDS and has died of COVID-19 at the age of 62. Denver Bible Church pastor Bob Einhardt made local headlines last year when he sued his state over its mask mandate. And then this year when he called for a boycott of the COVID-19 vaccines. A pastor at the Denver Bible Church, and Einhardt made the families of people who died of AIDS angry in the 1990s when he would gleefully read their obituaries on his show, Bob Einhardt Live, call them sodomites, and then play Another One Bites the Dust by Queen. There are photos of him reading these obits, just happy. And now he's dead. Both he and his wife got COVID and recently as a few weeks ago, and they are dead now. And look, I don't relish in it, but I will say good riddance, honestly, because that man is trash.
I get the temptation to gloat. I get the temptation to take some satisfaction at his death. I think the unfortunate thing is, you know, progressives and Democrats, I think we realize that even the Bob Einhardts of the world are somebody's father or grandfather or uncle or son. And those family members, the rational ones, probably already had such a problem with who this guy turned out in terms of being a human being. And now that he's dead, it's even sort of worse because it's sort of like, look, his life could have been so much better. And so I get the temptation to sort of relish and sort of enjoy and take some satisfaction about the chickens coming home to roost. But I think at a certain point also, we as Democrats and progressives have to say, okay, these are still human beings who had family members. And maybe the way to somehow try to get across to some of these folks is to show, I guess, some compassion to their family members who certainly realize that these people made a mistake.
Sure, but just for some context about those family members and a little bit of pushback, Einhardt was convicted of beating his wife's 7-year-old son in 1994 so hard with a belt that he broke the child's skin. He remained a strong proponent of spanking children, saying that, quote, kids' hearts are lifted when they're hit. Obviously, he also protested massively against reproductive rights. He thought that Planned Parenthood was doing child killing. He wants babies, I guess, to be born so he can then hit them and lift their hearts. I totally disagree. This guy is better not spreading this much hate.
You convinced me. He was pure evil. I'm not going to say I'm glad he's dead, but I do think society is better with him no longer part of it, and certainly his family is better with him no longer around.
I mean, yeah, and look, I don't. Yes, obviously he was loved by somebody, but like, you know, let's be real. Like, Republicans talk about and conservatives talk about natural selection all the time, survival of the fittest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And like, I think we should be able to say that once in a while. Look at COVID and look at the people that it's taking. Look, especially, and again, when it comes to individuals, who are not, you know, forward facing, you know, radio hosts, I do not relish in those folks and their death at all. I think they are a product of a lot of misinformation, but they're the product of the misinformation being spread and the hatred being spread by people like this guy. By Bob Einhart, right? Who spread all these lies, was a crazy raging homophobe. And I say, you know, goodbye, good night and good luck. And good night and good luck to all you. We gotta go. We got more on the YouTubes. So see us there later.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.